this in to us, the staff people, it was advertised for 8:15. So there's a lot of confusion there. Even for 8:15, we're running a few minutes late here. This is Irish week. We're on Irish time, so that's okay. Graduate early. This panel discussion is presented by the Augusta Heritage Arts Center, obviously, and more specifically, we are, most of the members of the Step Dance Week staff, and Joe O'Donovan, one of our members here, is technically on the Irish Week staff. And really what we want to do is just talk about the relationship of our dance. We are all percussive step dancers, traditional or otherwise. We do different forms of tap dance or clog dance or step dance that is based in different ethnic traditions, and we have pushed it, or it has evolved possibly beyond its original origins, but one thing we have in common is that we are percussive dancers. We make sounds with our feet. And so the panel discussion really is for us to discuss and try to present our views about what we're doing, not only as dancers, but as musicians who make sounds while we dance. Some of the traditions that we have represented here are improvisational traditions. Some are choreographed. Regardless of that, our dances are superimposed on the music or are part of the music. So it really is a big part of what we do to talk about how we relate to music and how we think about our own dance forms. So that's the gist of this discussion. And before anything, I'd like to introduce the panel members. First, from Port Hastings, Cape Breton, who is on the Step Dance Week staff teaching Cape Breton step dancing, is Harvey Beaton. Talk to themselves a little bit about their influences, who they are, and what it is that they do before we start getting into much more specifics about the different forms and before we get too technical. So just, I think it might be appropriate for everybody to know the influences we all have and what our backgrounds are, and that would probably give you, it'll probably help out with the answers we give later on in the panel discussion. So I introduced everybody from Harvey down to Brenda, so let's go in a reverse order here. If Brenda, you could just tell us your own background, how you learned, where you come from, and what you do in two words or less.
And I'm so old that I have to do two words.
No, we'll try to keep this moving as quickly as we can, but you can have four words.
Okay, all right. Do I have to hold this close to me?
No, these are not amplification microphones. This is just recording microphones. Okay.
Well, I started as a dancer when I was 4 or 5 years old, with my mother, who was a lyric soprano and an elocutionist, a dramatic reader, which today you would call a storyteller. Then it was called an elocutionist. And my aunt, who was a coloratura soprano and a concert pianist, and I was the ingenue. I was the tap dancer with the low voice. They didn't ask me to sing.
She still is.
And when I began dancing, I studied everything. Ballet, tap, interpretive Egyptian at a very exoteric dancing school, and Spanish. And in terms of the tap dance, I'll just kind of specialize on that, on percussive dance. My early training and influences musically was classical music and traditional tap dancing. My teacher was a man called Professor O'Brien, So obviously I learned a fair amount of Irish dancing, which I didn't know that it was Irish at the time, nor did I care. It just made a lot of racket, and I liked that a lot. And a lot of, I guess, I did a lot of movie dancing and I did a lot of improvisation because I had a terrible memory. So that I couldn't do chorus work, I always had to star because I couldn't remember any of the steps. So I was an improviser, and when I became 15, I started to specialize in jazz tap and jazz dancing in general, and became very influenced by jazz music. And so that was many, many years ago, and I'm still continuing with that tradition, and I try to study the tradition of jazz music from its origination to right up to the contemporary and even indeterminate, or what is called free bag. So from New Orleans jazz to swing to bebop to free bag to indeterminate. I try to run that gamut and still include many of the early forms that I grew up in. So that's my life. Without the dramatics.
Nice.
There's still time for that. Norman?
Go, okay. I started to dance at 6 years old, and dance and play music because I was a cello player. So I started at this time, so we in the family were playing music a lot, and music listener and dancer. My mother's side, there was a family of jokers, good partiers and dancers. But I don't dance, I don't feel, I just remember these parties when I was pretty young. And thus maybe the kind of little influence maybe drove me later in hearing again the kind of music and dance I do. And maybe the first step I do was when I was playing cello on concert. I always tap my foot on the floor, and all the sister was obligated to put a carpet on the floor because I forget this foot and boom, boom all the time. So maybe it's the first step I try to do. And later I do a lot of dance of international folk dancing, Greek or European, East and everything. And I started to do French-Canadian at age of 13, 14, while I start to give, to ask some question to myself, why are these dances? And I was living in Montreal, and the only tradition in Montreal were these international dances, and all the people of the city forget the traditional square and everything. So I was in a folk dance group, we do a lot of choreography of imitation of French-Canadian dances. So it's the first French-Canadian dances I learned. It's with a full group. So I learned strict patterns, and I asked a lot of questions. Where does it come from? Is that the real thing? So I started to meet people in the countries, older people, and I started to dance with them maybe at the age of 15, 16, and I'll quit all that international dances, and so I start to make research at this time on the field with the traditional people on step dancing, square, and all the cartwheels, and I never stop. So I'm still here today to explain that and teach these things. So that's it.
Joe.
Well, unlike Brendan Norman, it's so long ago. I can't remember.
Now, wait.
But I must have been possibly the same age, because I really can't ever remember when I started dancing. Because there was always dancing and music in the house. So I simply grew up with it, as did the other members of the family as well. My mother was a fine musician, a traditional musician. She played concertina, accordion, tin whistle, which were the sort of usual instruments that you would find in any Irish house of the period around the, say, 1920s. And so that's, you know, I'm talking about 70 years ago. I'm 71, so... But I can't remember, but I was certainly very, very young. And sometime in the early 20s, my father opened a dancing school, an Irish dancing school in Cork. And eventually my sister took over from my father. And this was about the stage when I began to sort of give up the dancing myself, because at that stage I had turned into a musician. And I joined a Cady band and played with McNamara's Cady band for a number of years. And then, because of the war, transport was very, very difficult. You simply couldn't get around. You could go to the dances that were within 5 or 6 miles because you could cycle there. But petrol was rationed, and the bottom fell out of the market, as it were. And I turned my thoughts to other things. And at that stage, I was working with an engineering firm. And immediately after the war, when things began to boom, I was moving around the country on any big engineering job that was going. I was on it. So it meant I was doing quite a lot of travelling. But the sort of side effect of that was that I picked up an awful lot of dancing throughout the whole country. And, you know, 50 years later, that made quite a difference, because when the revival of the old time dances, like the set dances, came about, I was probably one of the few people in the country who had some idea of what had been happening in earlier days, because I was involved both on the dancing side and on the musical side. So I came up with through a completely old-time traditional style of dancing, both solo step dancing and the set dancing, and of course the Cady dancing, because these were the dances that were always done in the house and at Fechina, at competition, and so on. So I had quite a good background in that. But I really had left the dancing scene at the time where it was still practically unchanged. The major changes took place in Irish dancing, you know, around the end of the war, middle of the 40s, beginning of the 50s. The changes that has now become modern dancing, because, you know, even the Irish dancers, teachers will now admit that what they're doing is modern Irish dancing, not traditional Irish dancing. And they realise this, and they admit it to themselves, of all the changes that have taken place. But I say I was unaffected by the change, because had I remained in the dancing circles, it is likely that I would have changed along like everybody else. But I happened to make the break at that particular time, so I was completely uninfluenced by what happened from, say, the middle of the 40s up to the present day. So my style goes back probably at least 200 years, because we have the names of dancing masters who composed some of the steps, which I do, and we can trace some of these back into the, as far back as 1750. So there's quite a... Some of the steps that you have seen me doing do, in fact, go back well over 200 years. So my style is the old style, which is completely unlike the modern style, in that dancing was done close to the floor. There was no high kicking, no high stepping. It was done with an economy of space. 3 feet square was all you needed to do your dancing. A ballpark isn't big enough now for some of the dancing that you see. They're all over the place. And, you know, these are just a couple of the changes that have taken place. One of the rules of dancing, of all dancing, was the fact that you should never see the sole of a dancer's shoe. Now, not only can you see the soles of the shoes, you can see a whole lot of other things as well. actually, you know, the influence was, in fact, you know, if you like, family influence. Because I came up with it, I never realized, and, you know, I probably should have asked a lot more questions, and I would probably have got a lot more information than I'd be able to pick up and remember eventually. But I think most of us are like that. We don't ask the questions at the right time, and it's too late when we think of it later. But during the years, I have picked up quite a fund of information on Irish dancing, and some people have been kind enough to say that I've had some influence in the revival of the set dancing, and certainly in the revival again of the old-time step dancing. So that's about it.
Great. Marvin.
Well, for me to begin, I'd have to say that this is a very formal setting for me. If you put me in here with a fiddle and piano and asked me to dance, I'd be much more comfortable. But because dancing is taken so much for granted where we come from, I do more dancing than talking.
Is there a fiddler in the house?
Nevertheless, I'll try to talk a little bit about it. I come from Cape Breton, which is an island in northeastern Nova Scotia, which is in eastern Canada. And Cape Breton was settled primarily by Scots in the 18th century. And with the Scots came the fiddle music and the dancing. And the fiddle music has evolved somewhat so that it is different from, although similar to, the Scottish fiddle music of Scotland. But the dancing, there is some question as to, you know, whether or not it did come from Scotland and all this kind of thing, but there is evidence to suggest that indeed it did, although today they don't do the kind of step dancing. In fact, I don't know that they do step dancing as such in Scotland, but in Cape Breton, it is certainly alive and well. And the reason I became interested in it was because I was brought up in a home where fiddle music was popular. My parents didn't play, but they did have friends and relatives who did play, and house parties were very much part of our growing up. And for children, there were seven of us to be, you know, included in these house parties, that was part and parcel of it. You know, we weren't shooed off to bed. We could just be there if we wanted to be. And I chose to be there, whereas my other brothers and sisters really didn't give a hoot about the whole thing. But I really did. I really enjoyed the music. We had a piano and we had, you know, sessions. So when I was in my teens, or just preteens actually, I used to hang around or chum around with friends of mine who were cousins, actually, and they were very involved in step dancing and fiddle and piano and music, and I loved it, but I couldn't do anything, and I really wanted to learn to dance. So my mother, who was a step dancer in her day, she used to do a bit of dancing around, said that, you know, she'd teach me a few basic steps, so I thought it was marvelous. So she'd teach me, when I was about 13 years old, she started to teach me a couple of steps, and she'd be in the kitchen doing dishes. I'd be in the living room practicing the steps, and she'd be telling me they're all wrong. But I couldn't figure out how she would know this. She wasn't even watching. But she could tell, of course, and I understood later on why she could tell. So she taught me a few steps, and at that time, step dancing wasn't being taught widespread as it is today. You know, it was being taught in Sydney, which would have been, you know, almost 100 miles away, and I wasn't going to go trotting off to Sydney at the age of 13 years old. But lo and behold, it was fate that a lady down the road from us, who was very highly regarded as a step dancer, was teaching classes. So I readily got her phone number, found out who this woman was because my mother knew who she was and had a lot of respect for her, called her up and asked if I could be in her classes. But as it were, I remember saying she had a whole lot of students and didn't know if she could take anybody from outside the area. But she would get back to me after the first night registration. I couldn't wait. I went anyway. Went to the registration. And she said, sure, and take the class. And it just so happens that lady is here, is in our midst. Mini McMaster. There she is.
Oh, that's great.
So she taught me my first steps, quite a few. She had an 8-week session, I remember, a Friday evening. And I couldn't wait from one Friday to the next to get down to the hall, which was about 10 miles away from where I live, and dance. And I come home and I try to execute the steps as she had done them, and you know, go back the next week and ask her if they were okay. And no, they weren't sometimes, and she'd show me. I keep it up. I really liked it, and I liked to practice. But she only gave, she gave eight lessons, but she very kindly invited me to her house, so I went there for a couple of more lessons, and, you know, really started to pick it up and enjoy it. But the beauty about step dancing in Cape Breton is that it's done, you know, for exhibition at concerts. It's not a competitive thing. It's very much a social dance, and it's very much part of the social square dancing, which is widespread in every community. They have square dances. So I could go to square dances at age 14 and practice. And, you know, what's better than practicing, you know, to live music, to a place where everybody is dancing? And I think that's, you know, was really a beneficial to me to learn to dance, because, you know, I was exposed to it. And I danced in my first concert, I think, when I was 14 or 15. And just from there, one thing led to the next. And when I was first invited to come to a camp like this, which was probably in Washington State, I think, a few years ago, it amazed me that people would bring me there to teach them to step dance. And I've never even heard of step dancing, like beyond Cape Breton, I thought. But the enthusiasm was there, and to come here to do something like this, it's really a lot of fun. So I'm glad that I got involved. That's my story.
Well, we're glad you're here. The first form of step dancing that I got involved in was Appalachian clog dancing, and that was in the mountains of Philadelphia as I was going to college. But it really, in some sense, I do consider it a traditional introduction to it. It was, there was an incredible old-time music and dancing in Philadelphia, which is still around, it's a little bit more scattered these days. And I just socially, for a break from studies, I was a very serious student, got into the square dance as a sophomore. Back in, I guess it was 78, 79, I started going to square dances. And they were community-style square dances, old-time music by old-time musicians. Although young revivalist musicians, but still it was a scene, a lot of people played. There was a cooperative, different people would come each week and call. Different people would play. And anybody could show up, you didn't have to go to classes in square dancing or anything like that. And it really was a social outlet, and it really was a community dance. The same people would come back. You might not see somebody for several weeks, but eventually they'd be there again. They were in the community, though the community was based on this interest, as opposed to, you know, a community based on two square blocks or something like that. And the real core of that particular square dance was this cooperative of musicians, and they used to always meet out in media and have Thursday night potluck dinners, and everybody would bring boards to dance on and their instruments to play. And musicians of all different levels would show up. Dancers of all different levels would show up. And it was really just basically a social outlet that these people were involved in. And it was through that scene, this sort of revival scene, that I got interested in it. And through the square dancing, I heard old-time music. And there were three clog groups around Philadelphia at that time. And the clog used to always show up at the square dances. And there was a corner of the stage, a corner of the auditorium up by the stage, off the stage right. And all the cloggers, if they weren't in the square dances, they'd stay up there and they would clog, because it was the same music. And so I started picking up steps just by watching, and people would show me things. And one of the groups ran a five-week session, so there were a few sort of introductory lessons there. But a lot of it was then going out to the bar afterwards and socializing with these people and going to the jams and just watching and imitating and either getting what I was trying to imitate or basically making a mistake. But if I could make the mistake fit the music, it was just a variation. It wasn't a mistake, which is really a big part of that particular tradition. And that really got me into it. And since then, I've been down south to fiddle conventions. The dance that I do would be more considered traditional flat footing, or is based more on the traditional flat footing, than it would be on the precision and competition clog dancing, which I'm not at all part of. So the people that I'm usually around and quote the scene that I'm part of is more a traditional music scene than it is a clog dance scene. The people I usually visit and spend time with are the old-time musicians or old-timey dancers, as opposed to the quote, the cloggers and all that. With the English clogging that I do, I did have a teacher who taught me lessons in the beginning, a gentleman named Tony Barron, who's an Englishman living in this country, though he didn't start clog dancing until he already lived here. So I don't know how much of a true English clogger that is, but his teachers, in turn, were English people. He'd go over to England and learn, and he also would hook up with English people who came to this country. And through him, I did have, it wasn't class, it was an apprenticeship. It was one-on-one in his basement for the course of more than several weeks, like 20 or 25 weeks throughout the winter and spring for the year that I lived up there. So the English clogging that I do is more of a traditional education or a formal education in the sense of being an apprentice to a teacher. The Appalachian clogging was more part of being part of a pool of dancers and being part of a community. So that's where that comes from. I won't talk about any other influences because we have them represented here. There's no reason for me to talk about them. What I'd really like to do now that you know more about us, though, is get into what the panel discussion is really supposed to be, and that is have us talk about how our dance forms as percussive dance forms interact and relate to the music we're dancing to. Even if it's a cappella, there's music going on there. And one of the big differences between a lot of the forms is the aspect of, is there improvisation involved in a form? Or is everything choreographed ahead of time? Or if things are not choreographed completely, are there steps that are known? And do you simply reorganize the steps, or do you create steps? So let's say, we'll just keep zipping back and forth across the line here. Let me start with Harvey this time. And just ask if you could comment on, when you dance, are you improvising? Do you make up steps as you dance? Or have you made up steps ahead of time and then dance your own steps? Or what is the tradition and all that?
Well, the improvisation is limited in terms of dancing and performance. If I was going to dance in a concert, chances are I wouldn't make up a step on the stage. But surely beforehand, I might choose to make up a step. But there are definitely, you know, a number of steps that are common with all dancers, and then there are individual steps, okay, a step that might be unique to myself, a step that might be unique to another dancer. I can learn his step, or he can learn mine, but there's a whole raft of steps that everybody knows, but not all dancers know all the same steps. Is this what you're looking for?
Yeah, that's very much along the lines. So then, if in a performance you do have steps that are basically set, but the order that you put those steps in is pretty open?
The order is open. Uh-huh. I might choose to have an arrangement of certain steps just so that I can remember them, but then, you know, do whatever else comes to mind, and then finish dancing and say, well, I forgot to do this, and why didn't I do that? But for the most part, you know, I have a certain number of steps that I'm bound to do when I dance, and some more that I'll do them if I think of them. And I think that's probably true for a lot of dancers. Although, if you see like duets, which is not really common, but there are some dancers who dance in pairs, they definitely have a synchronized routine. For individual dancers, go with the flow. Depending on the music, too. If the music, you know, really gives you the drive you want to dance, and I think you become creative, and you can become creative on stage and think of something maybe that you've never done before. And I always maintain that the dancer is only as good as the music. If the music's good, then you're going to dance well.
Joe?
Well, I suppose I'm a hardcore traditionalist. So I very seldom have made up steps. I have this fear all the time that if we all keep making up steps and they become known, that in fact they're going to replace the older steps which will be forgotten. And to some extent, you know, that had really happened. And it has happened that modern Irish dancers know very little of the old traditional steps, simply because the teachers haven't got them, and you know, there's a whole pile of stuff that has been lost. And I think I made a very conscious decision myself, you know, not to become part of that sort of movement. Hence, I've composed only just a couple of steps, and only rarely would I improvise. And that would depend like have they said, and the music, you know, the music gets into the blood rushes to the head, and then that's it, it goes from there down to the feet, and sometimes you're not even conscious of what's happening there, except the feet take over, and you put in these little extra little tips, and you change the movements around, the ones that should be in front turn out to be at the back, and so on, and that happens, and there's nothing wrong with that, because improvisation is part of a very old tradition in the west of Ireland, where dance is, and in fact where ballad singing is concerned as well. Shannos singing in the old style allows for improvisation. In fact, you know, they sometimes boast that even a song which has 14 verses is never, each of the 14 verses are different. And the same thing applies to the form of dancing they do as well. As distinct from the very rigid approach that modern dancers have, the old Shannos dancers in the west of Ireland would make full use of the hands to balance themselves at any particular time. And their boast is that they never know what they're going to do next. Their main purpose is to accompany the music, whereas most dancers seem to think that the music is there simply to accompany the dance. The old-time dancers have the opposite way around. You know, that they will dance to the music. And, you know, that's a very reasonable approach in a way, but it certainly brings about in people this improvisation, because you listen to the music. When the musician decides to change from D to G and goes into a different tune, that extra little drive, you can feel it even in the audience. The audience will start to sit up and take notice when you get a change like that from one tune into another, and particularly where there's a change of key, people get sit up and take notice, and so does the dancer. And it is at stages like this that he will improvise. But generally speaking, personally, I don't do much, because I do have this fear that if there's too much improvisation and too many new steps, that we're in danger perhaps of losing many of the older ones that should be part and parcel of every step dancer's repertoire.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Come on. Okay, the steps I do are came from a lot of people like me, and the way I use these steps, it's always in order of the moment, the feeling I have of these people and the music which is playing. So when I talk in improvisation or getting steps one before the other one, I have all these steps and kind of the music is talking to me, so I figure for if I play with like Angelique Saint or something else, I figure a lot of people doing these steps, and it's pretty hard to compose right on the spot. I think it's kind of impossible, because it's not the pattern you have in your head, in my head when I do the steps, it's only to do or represent the style or the kind of step what I see when people were doing these the step and on their music. I have a kind of pattern of step in the head, and it's only the feeling to give these steps only on the kind of the whip of the fiddle or if it's an accordion, the whip of the how you say the kind of
the bellows.
No, the just what I say is, if the music is poor, nothing got in your head, so you don't want to do any, not nothing. So, but all the steps I do is kind of exactly the steps I see. Maybe I give my style of my kind, but of a style, but the way I do it's exactly what I see when I make research, or when I talk, or when I dance with the people in solo or in duet, or
in this evening. So I don't go for improvisation. I do some sometimes for folk dance group who give me a command to an order. We need 2 minutes, 42 seconds of step dancing, and the group gonna perform. So these guys, I think it's weird, but I do it because I did better me than I know another one. But I compose steps, so I say, what kind of music do you want to have? Oh, anything. We just want to learn. So it's this kind of city groups who don't know anything about dancing and step dance. They just want to perform, give a show. So I think, no, it's not a good way. So try to learn the dance correctly before perform. So I write steps as I feel in the music if I was on the stage. Or so I just write, I listen to the music and bounce this step might be good like this. So I write steps last, I suppose, to dance. So that's what I write, but I never, when I write this and I teach, I don't remember nothing. I just keep going with these steps, and I never restart or rebuild steps for myself when I do dances. Maybe it's easy to compose or to do things, so I don't want to fall in tap dance or other kind of style, because it's easy when you see, I see a lot of dancers, it's easy to catch a step here, step there, and I don't want to lose the things I want to give, so I just keep straight in myself. Not this one. No, don't touch. This is not French Canadian style. So it's hard sometimes to start to have fun. You would play with sounds, but I think the tradition is so much in the head. So I just want to keep going, and I ask sometimes the fiddler play this tune or play that. Sometimes they give something I don't know what to do on. So I just give poor steps with seven sounds. When the whip is going on, oh yeah, this guy, I remember, figure a lot of the traditional dancers. And all these dancers come from our French Canadian, our Irishmen in Quebec. So it's almost these steps I do, like old style, old tradition they have without taps, just on the sole and on the floor, doing one again the other one. So in the tradition, people in the dances, there's a moment in the evening where the callers stop all the dance and call one by one all the step dancers or all the people in the crowd. So people have to show and to come and to perform. They just give off 35, 40, or just 1 minute of step dance, but they have to go. It's like not a contest, just a moment in the evening where it's go, give yourself, go step. So they play only one tune. It's called the Grand Jig Simple. It's kind of beat or 3/6/4 beat. So it's the most popular tune. So people go there, and when they are called, they have to go there. You have to perform. You have to improve, show. They do so only one or two steps. So people dance only one or two or three steps, not more. The tradition don't keep going with people with a lot of steps and prrrr, and it's not, no. People know 2-3 steps, and they do all the time the same in different kind of pattern, but all the time the same way. So when there's 10 or 12 or 25 step dancers who going in the evening to just perform, because it's a part of the dance to go there, so you have to do your step, so you just have fun, you dance with the musician, kick up in the air, and you change. So there's a kind of tradition for it. There's a lot of good step dancers, and that's where I look the steps and take the style. So improvisation, no, there's no kind of creation. You're just going with the music and remember what people do, and you do the same. So just feel the music and the party, and that's it.
That's it. Oh, I don't think I should be sitting here. I'm in the wrong place. All of a sudden, I feel how I'm not supposed to be here. I think I probably learned my first dance. I performed all my life and first learned the shim sham, which is the the Rhythm Tappers national anthem when I was 36 years old. I would not learn a routine by anyone. Never would I do anybody else's steps in performance, ever. And not only that, I was so proud, I would not even perform my own steps. Wouldn't make any up.
Good trick. Nobody else's,
not even my own.
Who were they?
They would just came through me. Now, I was very proud that I never knew what I was going to do when I walked on stage. That was my biggest pride. And that whatever musician was there, we would play off each other, and I would just go from the top. Then, after a while, I said, you know, I don't think I'm creating very much. I think even though I'm not doing steps, I think I'm repeating myself. I think, you know, that I'm not as clever as I thought I was.
But you were proud.
I was proud. Not very clever, but very proud. So I started making my own material when I was about 38. I'm 51 now. And I made my first dances even for myself when I was 38 years old. And had a terrible time. I remember when I first performed them with two other gals, I had a company. It was a nightmare. I hated that first concert because I actually had to remember something. And it was horrible. I said, this is not dancing if you have to stand up and remember how to do a step. This has nothing to do with art. This has to do with some kind of technical thing. And I always thought that all the people in my tradition, just rhythm top, that's the way they all danced. I was under that illusion that they all improvised. And then I did a documentary on the copacetics, and where I taped them for a week, and I kept seeing the same steps. And I finally caught on that these people were doing the same act for 50 years. And I said, wow, no wonder everybody thinks they're so good. They polished their material. So I started to compose and have learned now the luxury and the wonderfulness of subtlety and nuance, which sometimes I can hit it in improvisation, subtlety and nuance, but generally it's a great delight. I do one-person shows that are usually close to 2 hours long. And it's a great delight to have 60% composed material that I can do or not do as I choose, you know, again, depending on the musicians. And, you know, if the musicians are terrible, it really helps to have composed material. If they're so terrible they can't play that, it's really great not to need any. You know, it's very handy not to have to do anything but make up your stuff if they're really bad. But I usually work with about 60% composed and 40% improvised. And I like to at least make 25% of that 40% totally free, where I don't know what I'm going to do at all and compose on the spot. The other, I'll probably pull in something from over here, a figure from here, a figure from there that I've created, and use somewhere else that seems to go very nicely at this particular spot to this particular music. But I do find that if I'm not improvising enough, I lose my chops for it. That the kind of quickness that is necessary to improvise, you must practice improvisation the same as you practice figures, or else you get sloppy with your improvisation. You lose your wit. Because when you're improvising, you're really from scratch with a musician, or even by yourself, you have to hear every note that happens, and you have to anticipate. And you have to start a line. If you're going, shut on gao, you know you're going to shut a go gao, dao go, heat up, ho, shut on you, dao, di do, ba ba, dao, ka li da. You've got to at least be able to think that long. You can't just think shut ba. Because if you did, it would be very static, you know. So your mind has to be trained to think over long loops. and to anticipate the musician over a long loop. When the musician starts, you anticipate where the musician is going to go. So even if you're wrong, you've made some kind of a decision, and you're off on a journey together. It's very, improvisation, it really requires as much skill, if not more, than, for myself at any rate, than my composed dancing. My composed dancing needs a lot of practice, real practice. But the improvisation needs the wit that can get very lazy if you're not doing it all the time. So anyway, I'll just turn my back. I don't have to call.